Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our podcast where we talk about new books in media and communications. I am your host, Marcy Maserato. With me today is Donald Barclay, author of the book Disinformation, The Nature of Facts and Lies in the Post-Truth Era. Donald, welcome back to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be back.
Yeah. So, we've had you on before with your previous book. So this is your second book, right? Disinformation.
Second book on information. I've written other books on other topics.
Right. So because do you see this as part of a continuation for your previous book?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I've been telling people the first book, the book Fake News, Propaganda, Plain Old Lies, was kind of a how-to about managing information and misinformation and trying to evaluate credibility. And I've been telling people this book is more of a how come things are so fraught and contentious in this information world we're living in right now.
Yeah. And can you just remind our listeners what you're currently doing, what your background is, and kind of what led you to really thinking about disinformation, both from that practical how-to standpoint and the more theoretical standpoint?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm the deputy university librarian at the University of California, Merced, and I've been a librarian for 30 years. Before that, I taught writing, college writing for 4 years, and I also worked as a wildland firefighter in my youth. So I've done a few different things. But the fake news book really got started with the 2016 election and all the furor about fake news that sprung up at that time. It became a real hot topic. And as someone who's been teaching people about information for a long time, I realized, hey, this is exactly what I've been teaching people about for years. I really should say something about it. So I wrote the fake news book, really thinking about an audience of maybe college students, but also adults who are struggling, like, well, how am I supposed to know what to believe? And how do I really evaluate information, which is easier said than done? You know, evaluating information is nuanced, and certainly our feelings and cognitive biases and prejudices and ideas about the world make it all the more difficult to do that. So that was what the fake news book was about. And then the disinformation book was really a follow-on to that, because I felt like, well, I was pleased with the fake news book, but I thought, you know, there's really a lot more to say about really philosophically why is this so hard, and why are we in this state of such turmoil, which is not entirely new. There's always been turmoil over information, and you know, if you go back to ancient times, philosophers asking, well, what is truth? You know, what can we really believe? What's reality? What's an illusion? It's not a new question. And even things like conspiracy theories are very old, and people using information to gain wealth and power and influence over others is really old. But I feel like my thesis in disinformation really is that the digital technology has really amped up the problem and made it more noticeable. And because we live in the information age now, it's made it that much more urgent for us to come to terms with this. And we're dealing as a world, dealing with this fairly new technology that we haven't had a lot of time to assimilate and really come to understand. So anyway, in the disinformation book, I'm really trying to look at, you know, why are we in this state? What's different about it because of digital technology, and to an extent, how might we deal with it? So that's kind of where I came from on this book.
And full disclosure, obviously, I've already endorsed the book officially. So I'm on the back, which I was very honored to get that email from the publisher. So thank you for thinking of me. And I really do. Oh, go ahead.
Thank you for your endorsement, of course. I appreciate that greatly.
Yeah, and I would certainly not endorse something I didn't truly believe in. So I really do. I love this book because I like the way that you write, because you write from a very it's accessible, and it's just great. You know, and I say that even as a scholar, because I try to do that in my writing as well, to make it these kind of, you know, this accessible book. And I think that, you know, this book, this your other one was great as well. And this one, I can definitely appreciate it from a scholarly perspective, because it does have more of that kind of theoretical component to it, but it's still very, it's easy to read, which is great. And you can really like wrap your head around it in a way that you're like, oh, that makes sense. Because you really take these complex things, you know, and just talk about them and explain them. And I really appreciate that about your book.
Well, thank you. And I think, you know, my writing style is partly just my nature. I like to tell stories, really, and that I don't write fiction, but I like to tell a story when I'm writing, and to make ideas that are complex more accessible. And, you know, other people, of course, you know, the brilliant, you know, the Noam Chomskys and stuff, they can make things as you know, and the Foucaults and the Derridas can make things complex, and they're brilliant too in their way, and those are great works to get your head around. But that's not my style, and I'm not comparing myself to those brilliant minds either. I'm not in their league, but I enjoy trying to write for an audience that I imagine as intelligent and probably educated, but I'm not really trying to write to, you know, the top 1% of brilliant intellectuals or anything like that. That's not my audience.
And that's okay. So you're right. Like Chomsky, you know, Chomsky, Foucault, Derrida, they're great, but Derrida is notoriously insanely difficult to understand. That us scholars, we kind of bond on that. We're like, oh, we gotta read Derrida now.
Oh, I know. You know? Well, so yeah.
It's like a passage, you know, it's, so just let's start with the basics in terms of the idea of disinformation, because I think there's even been a shift with how we talk about quote fake news, whereas now we're really referring it to as a disinformation and misinformation, because there is such a thing as real fake news, right? Things that are purposely made to be fake. So can you talk a little bit about that distinction and even the evolution that you've seen in the just in a few years from your first book and your second book related to this topic?
Well, disinformation is not entirely new. Obviously, you know, you go back and look at Nazi Germany, or, you know, you look at the culture wars that were going on during the Protestant Reformation that turned into bloody gun and knife wars. But people have for a long time have tried to control people using information as a weapon. And again, digital technologies just made it that much easier to weaponize information. And I think that people realize that, well, if I can win somebody over with information and with disinformation by telling them a story that's largely untrue or constructed in such a way that it causes people to not really think about the whole breadth of all the things that are going on. And I think a great example of disinformation is simply the kind of reductionist way of presenting really complex problems. And often it involves blaming somebody else. We live in the Central Valley. We have water problems, water shortage. And of course, agriculture is a huge multi-billion dollar industry here. And it's really easy for one group of people, the sort of John Muir environmentalists, Save the Earth people to go, it's a bunch of billionaire investor people who are sucking all this water dry, and they don't care about the Central Valley, and they're going to suck all the water dry, and then when it's gone, they're going to go on and invest in something else, and we'll be left holding the bag, and it's their fault. And then you sort of got the conservative farmer view, which is, it's Gavin Newsom and these liberal politicians are dumping all our water into the ocean to save a bunch of fish, and they're causing the drought, and if we just built more dams, and, you know, it's a very simplified way of looking at the problem. But it really ignores a really complex problem with lots of people to blame. And, you know, of course, it's always easier to blame other people than yourself, right? To point the finger elsewhere. So disinformation often involves blaming somebody else, absolving ourselves of any guilt in the process, in the problems. And that if you can, I think because digital technology has made it so easy to spread information through a lot of channels and do it really cheaply and quickly, that it is at least tempted people who have agendas and want to shape thinking and shape events to realize, oh, if I can change somebody's mind through telling them a story, then I don't have to get a gun and shoot them in the head, right? And it's actually cheaper to do it that way than the other way. Now, you look at what's going on in Ukraine, and obviously Vladimir Putin decided that he wasn't changing anybody's mind through disinformation and took it to the next, unfortunately, to the next bloody and horrible extreme of actually shooting people and killing people. And it's a big mess. But I think that, you know, until ruthless kind of leaders get to that point, I think, especially in the digital world, that we're still trying to figure out how far can we go, how powerful is information in this new world, that they're willing to try a high level of disinformation before they resort to other ways and more conventional and awful ways of trying to make people fall into line and do their what they want.
Yeah, and you start, so your first chapter, you really start talking about the meaning of truth and the post-truth culture. So let's start with, how do you define what does post-truth culture look like? What is that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's, you know, I struggled with what to call it, because if you say, you know, post-truth environment, then it, you know, it sounds like you're talking about climate change, and that's not what I'm talking about, you know. And I wanted to try to find a way to express that idea. And I think post-truth culture is, it's tied into the, which I get into more in the final chapter, but this idea that we're living in a world where popular culture and really the kind of entertainment that comes with popular culture, and by that I include, you know, sports, and in a way politics have become a form of entertainment to a lot of people. Advertising, all of these things that have gotten into the pop culture bubble, that because pop culture is really just about a way of making money and exerting influence, that it's kind of become the culture. And it's like, in advertising, with some limits, does truth really matter? In telling a fictional story, whether it's on a soap opera or a sitcom or a something that passes as a news program but really is entertainment, does telling the truth really matter? You know, does it really matter that six young people living in New York could never afford the lifestyle of these great apartments and hang around a coffee shop chatting with each other for hours on end? That's a fiction, but it doesn't matter because it was one of the most popular sitcoms in the history of television that made a lot of money, right? So I think that that's helped shape the post-truth culture, because in this larger popular culture bubble that we are living in, and it's become also a more participatory culture because of digital technology. People can be participants in it. In the 90s, you sat there and watched Friends or Seinfeld. But now you have these ongoing digital dramas unfolding, you know, where you become a participant in Will Smith slapping Chris Rock, you know, and your comments and your reactions and your likings and your dislikings, it becomes, you become a participant in the show, and it becomes in a way real to you, even if maybe your understanding of it is incomplete and not very real.
Yeah, you know, as someone who studies, I spend a lot of time studying popular culture, and it really is incredibly powerful, you know, just popular culture in general, which obviously is, it's a huge term. But as you mentioned, like using, you know, Friends or, you know, Seinfeld and these really, really popular 90s sitcoms as an example, and with how we have social media now, we definitely have, you know, as Henry Jenkins talks about, like a convergence culture, both in the technology as well as participation and participatory culture with fandom and things like that. How damaging do you think that is? Do you think that it's actually better to have the participatory culture, or where do you think that line is in relation to kind of situating ourselves in this post-truth era?
That's an interesting thought. I mean, you know, if you watch Seinfeld, I'll go back to Seinfeld, you know, and you go, oh, yeah, George Costanza is just like my friend Phil, you know, and so you sort of believe that George is real, but you know he's not real, and you know your friend has some characteristics of George Costanza, and George Costanza is an interesting character because there are things about him that are very real and we recognize in other people. If he was a fictional, a totally made up character, we wouldn't respond to him very well. I mean, not that George is the greatest example of
right,
a human
yeah.
being,
but I get it.
But you know, I mean, we wouldn't laugh at him. We wouldn't find him entertaining. So, but we, you know, there's that sense of, well, Seinfeld is kind of real, but I know it's something different. And in a participatory culture, I think it may be healthy to participate in something like a political idea that's flying around, and you know it's on Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat or whatever you use, and you're making snarky comments about and or weighing in, or you know, I see a lot of you know, on Facebook I see older people my age, I'm old, you know, waxing nostalgic about the past, and I can kind of chuckle along with it. But I can also step back from that and go, yeah, they're remembering the past, but they're not really remembering it all that accurately. You know, they're fictionalizing the past as something, as older people often do, as something way better than the present. That's a very common cognitive bias to believe that the past was somehow better. And that's fine, you know, in a way to participate that and say, oh, yeah, I remember when gas was 29 cents a gallon, you know, and that was good times. And, you know, why can't these students just get a part-time job and work their way through college the way I did, when literally my first semester of college cost $180. That's true. I remember the check, you know, not anymore, you know, and even if you can't factor in inflation, it was like the equivalent of about $700 today, you know? So that's sort of misremembering the past as an example, and it's kind of harmless. But then obviously if you take it too far, if you take it to the point of really starting to dislike and mistreat young people and really lash out against them in ways that are tangible and intangible, maybe, that's very harmful. You know, that's where it gets into the real world. It's sort of like if you were, I'll use QAnon as an example, if you're really into QAnon, and it's kind of like a show to you or a team that you follow. And, you know, you're on the QAnon team just like somebody roots for the Dodgers or the Giants. Or you follow QAnon the way somebody might follow a soap opera. And you really get into it. I mean, if it's just you being online and you're not really doing anything actively and it's just something that it's kind of an entertainment for you, even if you don't kind of process that it is entertainment. It's kind of harmless. It may even be a good outlet. But obviously, if you start, you know, stocking up guns and planning to kill people, then it becomes a real problem, obviously. And so that's, I think that's where the danger is when does participation in something like this become less just fandom and more something really dangerous? It's like, again, using the analogy of sports, it's great to be a Dodger or a Giants fan and root for your team. And I've sat in ball games where I'm a Giants fan and we make fun of the Dodger fans who are there and they make fun of us. And, you know, we make jokes and we say, oh, hey, it's the first inning. Have you ever seen the first inning of a game before? Because Dodger fans are notorious for coming late, you know, and they make some fun of us about the Giants and blah, blah, blah. And that's fine. But when, you know, often fueled by alcohol, when people start throwing punches at each other and beating each other up, and then the videos go online and people, you know, Dodger fans are me tooing that the Dodger guy knocked a Giants fan on his butt, you know, and that's a very different kind of thing. That becomes really, you know, that's where it becomes really harmful, when it starts having those kind of effects in the real world.
And you mentioned, like, moving into your second chapter, you talk about the science of the mind in this post-truth culture. So you actually talk about really the way our brains work and how that leaves us vulnerable to disinformation. So can you talk a little bit more about how human psychology has a major impact in this?
Well, I've already mentioned cognitive biases, and everybody has them. Everybody does. And they often work on us without us realizing it. And the cognitive bias of seeing the past as better than the present, that's very common, you know, especially for, you know, as you get older, people develop that bias. So there's a bunch of cognitive biases out there, and I think I say in the book, there's some people who study human cognition have said a very interesting statement. They said, from an evolutionary standpoint, a cognitive bias is not a flaw, it's a design feature. Because the example I give in the book is, if you're living in the savannah of 200,000 years ago and you hear a noise in the bushes and your cognitive bias immediately goes, big cat, gonna eat me, and you shoot up a tree, that's a good cognitive bias to have. Because even if, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not a big cat, the effort you expend climbing the tree is worth it because you didn't get eaten the one time it is a big cat. You know, that's how cognitive biases work on us. We have these brains that were evolved in a time of stress of, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. But in the modern world, we still are walking around with those brains, but very few of our decisions are that lightning quick. And so a cognitive bias that causes you to run up a tree is useful in this stress environment, but it's not very useful for making a long-term financial investment or figuring out which political candidate is most likely to do good. Because, you know, we have the time to analyze these things if we take the time, which is hard and takes work. And our cognitive biases are not really very good at making those kind of decisions. And then I talk about Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who did this work with the idea of heuristics. And they actually, these are statistically based findings that they made back in the 1970s. And eventually Kahneman who's a psychologist, got the Nobel Prize in economics for his work with heuristics. But the idea is that we take these mental shortcuts because trying to think and really calculate the statistically of what's my best option is too much work, so we take a shortcut. And you know, they use examples like the gambler's fallacy, which is, well, the ball has landed on black 5 times in a row, it's due to land on red. Well, in a fair roulette wheel, that has no bearing on where the ball is going to land next. It's a heuristic, but people fall for that and use it, even though it's statistically invalid. But other kinds of heuristics that we use are generally useful. You know, they can be useful, but we rely on them too much, and then we end up making decisions that are not very well balanced. And an example would be, I'm walking down a dark street, and my heuristic tells me this is kind of a dangerous situation. I better be alert because I've seen a lot of movies, and I know from the movies this is a dangerous situation. So that's not a bad heuristic decision. You know, I'm alone on a dark street. I should be extra alert, extra cautious. You know, maybe keep my eye open as I walk past this alley to make sure there's nobody going to come out at me. That's not a bad heuristic decision. But if we extend that too far, we end up making really bad decisions about based on, you know, I'm walking down a regular street. And here comes somebody, and because of the way they look, I'm going to make a decision that they're dangerous or they're not trustworthy. Or I make a decision about somebody's personality and intelligence based on the way they talk. Because they have a southern accent, they must be a bigot and stupid. That's a bad heuristic. But people do stuff like that all the time.
Yeah, and it's incredibly damaging.
Right, it can be, yes. I mean, you know, heuristics are okay as long as you don't take them too far, but we tend to take them too far and then they become stereotypes and prejudices and so on. And that's where they really become problematic.
Yeah. And I think that's as you're kind of talking about that, I start going into really how we start using stereotypes as shortcuts in terms of judging other people. And then stereotypes are just inherently negative because they're created and they're used to so often oppress specific voices.
Right.
And they're implicit.
Mm-hmm. And that's getting back to the idea of disinformation, you know, the idea of people who are trying to mislead people, selling really simplistic ideas and simplifying problems down to, well, there's just this one cause for it and it's all their fault. That really plays on to these heuristics, you know, the shortcuts we take. You know, it's all the fault of this one group of people. They're the bad people. You know, it's the Ukrainians. They're a bunch of Nazis. It's all their fault. Simple story. There's nothing else to it, right? And that's an easy story to sell, and it's easy to glom onto that heuristically if you're living, you know, if you believe Vladimir Putin, and go along with that idea because it's simple. It's not complex. It's not, well, let's unpack 1,000 years of Ukrainian Russian history and, you know, right. And go through all the culture and language and geography and politics of the last 1,000 years to unpack what's really going on. That's hard, you know, and people don't, it's hard to do that homework.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, it's just a lot easier to live in the bumper culture, you know, bumper sticker culture type of thing where you just kind of water things down, which I understand, you know, from wanting to get, you know, people out into the streets and really, you know, advocate for a specific cause or something like that. You know, you want to have these, you know, slogans, if you will, that can be very powerful, but there also has to be the space to really unpack and understand what these condensed ideas may mean, you know, in protests and what, because there's often a very, very complex underlying history to all of these things, you know, obviously with this Supreme Court leak about Roe v. Wade, and just, you know, how there, I had read an article where there were particular, like there was a group of protesters that were going in or actually sending hangers to SCOTUS, and the abortion rights, you know, activists were saying that's actually going too far because they're talking about just how horrifying that imagery is. And they just don't want people like women to think that that's what they have to resort to. And I was like, that's, you know, that's actually, it's a perfect example of like, oh, right. We can't just do things just to be provocative. So there's a way to do it, to really not perpetuate really nasty stereotypes and really bad ideas, because there could be a young impressionable girl that doesn't, that may think that that's what she needs to resort to.
Yeah. Well, there's a, you know, I just heard a really good example. I would have put it in a book if I'd heard it before I wrote the book. You always, whenever you write a book, you always think, oh, I wish I could have included that. But and then there's also, I wish I hadn't said that, but let's not go into that. But, you know, I talk about Marshall McLuhan in the book. And of course, McLuhan really made his name talking about electronic media, specifically television. And McLuhan's very simplification of his idea was electronic medium is changing the way people think, the way the printing revolution changed the way people think. And, you know, a lot of what McLuhan said about television in the 60s, you go back and look at it and you go, ooh, he's kind of was calling what's happening now, you know, which is also, of course, electronic communication we're dealing with. But Eisenhower was the first presidential candidate to use television. And he was very opposed to this idea, but these Madison Avenue guys got to him and said, we're going to make TV commercials. They're going to be 30 seconds long. And Ike was like, no, that's not the right way to do it. You know, we need to explain our position. They go, no, you don't understand television. That's not how it works. So you had, you know, I like Ike, you know, and you had a little man on the street and woman on the street interviews of ordinary Americans, just like in soundbite saying why they liked Eisenhower. Adlai Stevenson bought half-hour time blocks where he sat there analyzing policy for 30 minutes. He got crushed because that's not how TV works. And he was making the idea too complex for television. And, you know, I think, again, you know, it's the bumper sticker mentality. You know, if it fits on a bumper sticker, it's probably not a very good idea. You know, it's not been thought through very well. And that's, you know, that's what we're, you know, as McLuhan was saying, you know, this electronic medium is really going to change the way we think. I think we're experiencing that in a pretty serious way, which I talk about that in chapter 4 of the book. But that in the digital world, where we're sort of, if McLuhan and people like McLuhan and Walter J. Ong are right and others, we're really moving beyond the book and the printed word as central, and we're not leaving them behind, but they're not as central as they used to be, that we're moving into this, what Ong called secondary orality, where things are really fast paced and really interactive. Well, that's where the soundbite and the clip and the, you know, the simplified idea can hold sway. It's like, you know, how much do we hear people talk about freedom in this country? And I'm not against freedom. I'm all for it. I totally believe in it. But it's in movies, you know, the end of Braveheart, freedom, you know, and there's songs about freedom, and, you know, it's mentioned in TV ads, you know, buy this vehicle, you'll have freedom, you know. But how often do we stop and anybody really, you know, certainly in popular culture, there's people say, well, what does it mean to be free? What does freedom really mean? You know, does owning a gun mean you're free? And some people say, yes, absolutely. But I think you could question that. I mean, gun politics aside, whether it's right or wrong to own a gun, and I'll be straightforward. I own a couple of guns. I grew up shooting as a little kid, a very little kid. I started shooting when I was 10. And I don't shoot much anymore, but I own guns. But, you know, does, you know, gun politics aside, does owning a gun actually make you free? And I would say, well, it's, you know, you could say, well, look at the Ukraine. Well, yeah, okay, they're fighting for their freedom with guns. It's certainly helping them. But I would say owning a gun means you're free. It's the same way that owning a wedding ring means you're happily married. You know, it's just something you buy, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't guarantee it anything. Really. Yeah. And by the way, I'm married and happily, and I own a wedding ring. So, you know, but I don't believe my wedding ring causes my happy marriage.
Sure. Right. It's not the material representation of it. Yeah.
Any more than I believe that that a gun really makes me free, that I could still own my guns and not be very free. I believe that could very well be the case. So, but the point is, we don't stop to analyze those things because that doesn't fit on a bumper sticker very well. And it doesn't, you know, when William Wallace is dying at the end of Braveheart, he doesn't, you know, there's not a 15-minute explication of what freedom would actually mean to a 12th century Scottish nobleman as opposed to some guy on the internet today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's where like Derrida, a reading of Derrida and like just how the definition, you know, differs and is just different. Like there are so many different ways to define the idea of freedom, but it does become, you know, in political speeches, it's just this thing that we hang on to, but I'm like, but what does it really mean? Right. Cause it can really become manipulative. And you talk about propaganda, right. And in terms of like, well, freedom is definitely a word that can easily fit in there because we hear it and we're like, oh, well, I like freedom. That's a good thing. But what does that mean? So when you talk about propaganda, you talk about the good, the bad, and the persuasive, how do you think it fits in with disinformation and what this really looks like?
Well, obviously propaganda is really old. And you know, I think that clearly if you're trying to, you know, if you're Vladimir Putin and you're trying to convince people that, you know, the Ukrainians are bad and you're justified, you certainly resort to propaganda. I mean, he obviously government propaganda, he's gotten the leader of the Russian Orthodox Church to endorse the war. That's clearly a propaganda move. And you know, obviously, you know, the word propaganda comes from a religious movement, a religious, you know, it was the Catholic Church that started the propaganda, although propaganda pre-existed that. So I think that, you know, it's a form of disinformation. I think that, you know, as I talk about in the book, it's kind of, you know, it's a difficult thing to talk about because our concept of propaganda, especially I think in the United States, is so negative that propaganda is just evil, you know, that nobody likes propaganda. Propaganda is like, you know, predatory child sex or something. It's just like, it's nobody wants that. Nobody likes that. It's just evil. But it's propaganda is around us. It happens all the time. And I think that almost anybody, you could show them some kind of propaganda for something that they believe in and show them why this message is propagandistic. And they would say, well, yeah, that's justified. You know, if for example, I don't even have a real example of this, I'm just spitballing here, but if you found something from promoting Black Lives Matter and you could analyze the message and say, this is a propagandistic message. Well, a lot of people would say, I don't care because it's conveying an important message that I believe in. And I think what, you know, the lesson for all of us is to understand, yeah, we're surrounded by propaganda. And pretty much every political message has a propaganda element to it. But what we really need to be aware of is, okay, I understand this message. I may agree with it or disagree with it or be neutral about it. And I really am thinking carefully about what's propagandistic about this. What part of it is trying to manipulate me in a way that is unequal? And I think that's part of the definition of propaganda, is that the purveyor of the propaganda is trying to convince the recipient to do something that may or may not be in the recipient's best interest. And it's always in the interest of the propagandist. The message always favors the propagandist. It may or may not favor the recipient. And that's what we really have to be aware of. And I use some examples in there of some, you know, election time propaganda from actually some elections that happened in California that are pretty much meaningless now because they're passed and nobody cares about them anymore. They've already been decided. But the idea is that on both sides, there were propagandistic messages, and your feelings about those messages really depended on how you felt about the issue.
And what do you think, or what are some of your suggestions for possible solutions to that on both those that should perhaps be creating better messages that are not propagandistic, as well as those who are receiving it?
Yeah, I think when people want something, when they want to win people to their cause, it's really hard to tell them don't be propagandistic. Because, you know, you're not going to get elected to office, and you're not going to get a cable news show if your approach is, well, here's the situation and these are the facts. And yeah, the people on this side, they have a good point of view and I understand that. But the people on the other side, they have this point of view and I understand that. And nobody, you know, is going to pay attention to that. You know, they want to, if you're going to persuade people, you have to come on pretty strong. So I don't know that you're ever going to persuade conveyors of messages to swear off of propaganda. But I think you can, what I would hope people would get from my book is just to be aware of that, to be aware of how you're being asked to think a certain way, the way the message is favoring the interests of the sender, and that you as recipient need to just be aware that, basically you're being manipulated. And I think it gets to going back to our conversation about freedom. There are times when I receive a message and I think about it and I go, well, you know, they're really trying to manipulate me here. But I'm willing to be manipulated because I think that what they're trying to get me to do or believe is a good thing. And it's the right way to do it, the right thing to do. And I can kind of separate that from the message itself, as opposed to not being aware that I'm being manipulated and then end up doing something that maybe I wouldn't do or is not in my best interest. You know, there's, as I say in the book, there's no campaign in the history of political campaigning that has ever told somebody, well, oh, you really shouldn't vote for our candidate or you shouldn't give us money because if we win, what we're going to do is going to be bad for you. They'll take your money every day and your vote every day, even though they know that what they have planned is going to be bad for you as an individual. And that's just the nature of politics and the nature of propaganda. Propaganda is about winning, really, and convincing people of doing things, maybe against their will. And we're surrounded by it. We get it all the time. You know, advertising is basically propaganda. And we need to be able to just try as best we can to think about what's really in our best interest. What do we really believe? What really matters to us? And I think, again, going back to freedom, I think that's the key of trying to be free. I mean, none of us can be completely separate from our upbringing and culture and language and DNA and all these factors that affect us. We can't step outside of those perfectly. But we can be careful about the choices we make and even the products we buy in asking ourselves, is this really what I feel is the right thing to do? And is this the right way for me to go? Or am I really being manipulated beyond a reasonable level for me? Because like I say, we all get manipulated.
And I think it becomes very dangerous when that manipulation turns into fanaticism for a particular cause or a particular, it could be product. It could be, you know, just fanaticism in general, I think is really dangerous. And certainly propaganda, just, I think that's what it seeks to do is kind of create fanatics.
Well, when it convinces you that it's okay to, you know, invade the Ukraine and start killing Ukrainians, that's a very bad thing, you know, or when it convinces you that you know, that your small group of people, you know, whatever little group you're a part of, maybe there's 100,000 of you in the United States, and the propaganda convinces you that your small group has the right to dominate everybody else in the country and tell them what they think, regardless of what they may think. You know, that's, to me, that's the real, you know, that's the no-go line of, you know, If you believe that you're better than the majority, and I know that there's problems with the majority and people being manipulated and all these other things, but at the end of the day, there's a famous quote that's attributed to Winston Churchill, and he may or may not have said it, but he said something like, democracy is the second worst form of government in the world, but every other form of government is tied for worst. So, you know, democracy is not perfect, but it's all we have, especially in the United States. That's what we're based on. And when people start going around saying our small group has the right to determine for everybody else, that's fanaticism at its worst. And that's people, I believe, who've been propagandized and in the worst possible way.
And kind of really, you know, looking at propaganda, you go in and talk about how information actually wants to be free and have its own freedom. And can you talk about why it's not? Why isn't information free?
Why information isn't free? Well, that's a really good one. And something I, you know, I deal with because I'm in the information business. You know, libraries buy information and make it available to people. So we deal with that, the dollars and cents of information all the time. And the fact is that all information costs money to create. And somebody has to do the work. And even if you're doing the work for free, if you're writing on spec, let's say, you have to have the time to sit there and do that work and create that information, the leisure to do that. You know, so if you were, let's say, the slave of somebody and they kept you hopping 80 hours a week and left you no time except to sleep and eat, you're not going to have the time and leisure to create that information, not to mention you don't have any tools for creating that information, whether it's paper and pencil or a computer or what have you. And you've also got to have access to, if you're going to create information and share it with people, you have to have a way of sharing it, which can be, of course, really expensive. Now, I think that what's happened in the digital age is that digital technology has made it a lot cheaper to create information and a lot cheaper to distribute it. Now, whether anybody actually picks up on it, you know, if you have a website, are people going to come to it? Maybe. If you put something on Twitter, is it going to go viral? Well, it could. Probably not, but it could. So it's made information seem a lot cheaper, but there's still a cost to it. You know, you have to have some kind of resource in order to create information and share information. And so there's always going to be a cost to it. And it means that also that information, besides having a cost, has a value. And that's why we've seen, especially as we've gone more to an information age and information economy, you've seen things like copyright become more important and more, copyright has gotten longer and more restrictive in some ways because that information is way more valuable in the digital age than it's ever been. There's money to be made. And in films and podcasts, even, you know, not every podcast makes a lot of money, but some of them do. And of course, even writing books still, you know, people like Stephen King make ungodly amounts of money writing books still. So the information has more value than ever. And it means that trying to extract that value and control the marketplace for that value has become more complex than ever. And controlling the other side of the digital age is that digital technology has made information cheap to create and to share, but it's also made it harder to control. And that's one of the things we're finding, of course, with copyright. One of the big struggles is that in the print age, copyright was pretty effective because it was really intended to stop one manufacturer from stealing the product of another manufacturer. One printing operation from stealing from another printing operation. And so it worked pretty well for that in the analog world, but it doesn't work so great in the digital world where you can copy something sitting at your desk in 2 seconds and share it widely in 3 seconds. So all of those factors have contributed to this world of where information, because it has value, And it has dollar value, and it has obviously political value when you can use information to control people and get your way in the world, that it's never going to be free. Even though it may seem like it's free, you know, and the idea of being on Facebook, you know, well, hey, that's free. It's a free service, right? But it's not free because they're using your content that you're creating. And they're using the information they gather about you to make money. And, you know, the title of my book is Disinformation, but I actually, at one point, I really wanted to call it We Sell Ad Senator, which is a quote from Mark Zuckerberg when he was testifying before Congress.
Yeah. Yes.
before the U.S. Senate. And the senator from Utah just died. I'm sorry, I just forgot his name. He just passed away. Anyway, this old senator asked Zuckerberg, you know, what's your business model? And Zuckerberg replied, we sell ads, Senator. And that's so true. You know, that it really is, you know, it's a free service that allows people to sell ads. In that sense, it's not that much different than old-fashioned broadcast television, which was a free entertainment service that sold ads. And that's how they made their money, obviously. But what we're seeing, the slightly different thing in the digital age is not only are we observing, we're not just watching Seinfeld, we're writing the script. We're providing the text for Facebook and Twitter and all of these other services. So, and of course, there's always, you know, part of the allure of the digital age and social media is, and I think a lot of young people especially are lured by this, is, oh, well, what if I go online and I become a big hit and I'm making millions of dollars suddenly? You know, and we read all these stories about, you know, young people who have, you know, Twitch channels and all these other things where they make millions of dollars. And it's a new version of the old story of, well, if I sit in a drugstore in Hollywood looking cute long enough, some movie producer is going to come by and put me in the movies and I'll be rich and famous. You know, it's kind of the same story, but it takes even less. You don't even have to go to Hollywood. You can sit in your bedroom with a smartphone and maybe you'll be discovered by the masses.
Right. And there's definitely a democratization of, like, you know, YouTube, for example, but, you know, even to be a filmmaker, there's still the distribution aspect of it. So there's the pros and cons to all of that. So we still, unfortunately, you have more outlets to create content, which do create sometimes visibility and people do get discovered, but then it also kind of gives a false sense of hope where that's still very rare. And I'm not sure that the rarity has really gone, that it's become that much more common. It's just become different, right?
Right.
With the technology we have.
And again, it's one of the pop culture stories that's not that true. You can go online and get rich. Well, some people do, a few people do, but it's not very likely, you know? And some of the things you have to do, if to get rich, you have to, you know, have a fans only site, you know, are you willing to do the things people do on fans only to make money? That's a choice that may come back to haunt you, you know?
Because when you say, oh, it's, you know, you have an OnlyFans account and then you're just like, oh, what is that? Yeah, it takes on a persona of its own in terms of what it is, you know, and there's certainly a lot of, there's legitimacy and fakeness in all of these different platforms, but they do, you know, they all tend to have their own kind of ideas of what the content is curated for. So it'll be interesting to see what's going to happen with Twitter now that one single person just purchased it.
Yeah. It's going to be very interesting because, you know, is he going to invite Donald Trump back on? And, you know, one of the things I talked about in Disinformation is the idea that Twitter is very much a secondary orality form of communication. It's post Gutenberg, it's post print, because even though it's based on writing, which is what secondary orality does, come out of writing, but it's very interactive, it's very fast paced, it's participatory, and, you know, one of the things I talked about in the book is Donald Trump was a master of Twitter, because he would, you know, he would say something on Twitter, and his stans would come in and go, yay, Donald Trump, you're so smart, we love you. And his haters would come in and go, ooh, boo, you're terrible. And then Donald Trump could respond to a stan or a hater if he felt like it or not. And it was this kind of back and forth, very performative kind of thing. And that's very typical of secondary orality. But then, you know, one of the things I mentioned in the book too is some of the people who were the most well-known people who hit back at Donald Trump on Twitter were stand-up comedians. But stand-up comedy is totally in that secondary reality mode too. It's based on writing. Most stand-up comedians write their routines, but it's performative, it's quick-paced, it's interactive. And if you've ever if you've ever listened to a recording of a stand-up comedian or watched a video, invariably, without exception, they're done before a live audience, because if you do stand-up comedy without an audience, it's pretty blah. You have to have that interactivity of a real audience there. And that's, you know, that's kind of, that's the difference between Donald Trump going on Twitter and going, well, climate change is a bunch of BS because somebody was talking about climate change the other day and it was snowing on her the whole time, ha, ha, ha. And that's totally different than Al Gore writing a 10,000-page think piece about climate change and publishing it in a magazine, which is very Gutenberg parenthesis printing tech way of thinking.
I mean, yeah, your book, as I mentioned, I'm a big fan of it, and we, you know, we barely scratched the surface today with this, so I do recommend that our listeners buy it and read it, and have these conversations with their fellow colleagues and other people in their lives. So, is this going to be a trilogy? Or are you working on the third one?
I don't know. I haven't really hit on an angle for a third book yet. I'm still kind of grasping for an idea, and you know, I'm not going to force myself. If I don't have something meaningful to say, I'm not going to write another book. But I suspect that because I'm always keeping an eye on information and you know, trying to find ways of telling a story about information, events, incidents, and so on. Reading things and listening to interesting podcasts and stuff. I may hit on an angle, and if I do, I will certainly try to write another book, but I'm not going to do one just to, oh, because I've already written two, I have to write the third one. A friend of mine said, well, now that you've written Disinformation, are you going to write Dat Information and Other Information? A bad dad joke from one of my dadly friends.
Yeah. I mean, this was just published, so again, congratulations on that. So you know, you can always just take in good information, and then I agree with you. If you're inspired to write, by all means, you know, keep me posted, and we'll have you on for the third time.
Thank you. I hope I come up with something worth writing about. And you know, one of the things I say about this book is I don't have any grand unified theory to explain what's going on in the information world today. You know, I don't have the answer. And I think, you know, as I read these chapters and I talk about things like the role of pop culture and I talk about conspiracy theories and propaganda, you know, all of my ideas, I think they should be looked at and analyzed, and people, when they read them, should read them critically and think, well, you know, what holds up, what doesn't, you know, how can I, you know, this needs to be picked apart, or maybe he's missed a point here, he's, you know, miss something. But I think the ideas, for the most part, are worth thinking about and worth pulling apart. And I think, again, that's really what managing information is all about, is really not just taking things at face value, not just accepting that sort of bright, shiny, simplified freedom, yeah, you know, version of life. You know, how does buying this big vehicle make me free when I have to make car payments and put gas in it and pay insurance and maintain it? And am I really free by having that? Or vice versa, does buying an electric car really make me free? You know, from gas, I'm free from buying gas, but what, you know, where does the energy come from? And, you know, all these other questions we have to ask ourselves. So we have, you know, to be mindful of things like that, and to be and you know, to be aware that our pop culture and propaganda and conspiracy theories and market forces, all these things are manipulating us, and you know, we just need to be we need to be aware of that and be mindful of that. And you know, if we are going to be manipulated, be mindfully manipulated. Realize, well, you know, I'm buying this idea about freedom here, and I realize they're trying to lead me down a certain path, but you know what? I think that's the right path, and I'm going to go down. That's okay. You know, but don't just follow it blindly. And that's kind of basic advice for living your life.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think that's very good advice. So I just want to, you know, as we wrap up, I just want to thank you again. I appreciate you you coming back on to talk about your second book. So thank you for joining us, Donald. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. I really appreciate it. So until next time, everyone, cheers.